Welcome to the Let's Talk EMDR podcast, brought to you by the EMDR International Association, or EMDRIA. I am your host, Kim Howard. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. In this episode, we are talking with EMDR certified therapist and consultant, Christina Anderson. Christina is located in Kirkland, Washington, where she specializes in providing EMDR therapy for sexual assault and abuse clients. Let's get started. Today, we are speaking with EMDR therapist, EMDR consultant, and virtual trainer, Christina Anderson, about EMDR therapy and sexual trauma. Thank you, Christina, for being here today. We are so happy that you said yes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to sharing my experiences. I think it'll hopefully help some EMDR therapists who are working with sexual assault survivors.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming an EMDR therapist.
Yeah. So currently, just to kind of give some background on who I am. So currently, I'm an EMDR therapist for a nonprofit organization. I work in Everett, Washington, aimed at helping sexual assault survivors and secondary victims process their trauma. I work with these clients one-on-one, as well as create and facilitate support groups for survivors, non-offending parents and caregivers of assaulted survivors. And I work with high schoolers as well. So I've been doing this work since 2016, so for the last 7 years, which is crazy. And I'm also a trauma supervisor certified through the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma, so IVAT, to assist with case consultations regarding childhood trauma and sexual assault trauma. So that's a lot.
That is a lot.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So I definitely got into this work just my undergrad was in women's studies. So one of my favorite courses was the violence against women, just because I had no idea how prevalent that was. One of my internships was at the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Corvallis, Oregon. And when I got hired on as a part-time staff member, I actually worked with survivors as a shelter advocate. So while I was kind of staying the night, making sure things were good, I got to hear some of their stories, and it was so empowering to kind of figure out like what had happened, where they are now, like what's going on, and kind of what their plans were for the future. And just being able to sit there and listen to those stories was so impactful for me, but also for them, just having somebody to listen to them and not judge them. So I really got into that work around like 2010, really just being a shelter advocate at this organization. When I went to graduate school, I had another opportunity to work for an organization that centered around like violence and sexual assault trauma. And so I did that, and that was amazing. And while I was at my graduate program, the wonderful Katie Murray came in from HAP, and she was able to kind of talk with us about how incredible EMDR therapy is, and especially how, you know, HAP, the humanitarian assistance program, is able to help with processing trauma for, you know, real world disasters, and kind of connecting those pieces of, this is what I want to do as a therapist, is work with, you know, victims of assault and violence, and I want to help them process their trauma. That just seemed to click for me. And when I attended the first training, which was October 2016, that just sealed the deal for me. I was like, oh, this isn't hypnosis. This is actual, like, real life scientific magic. And I absolutely have enjoyed EMDR since then. There's not a day that goes by that I do not use it with a client.
That's a great testimony. That's,
yeah.
That's great that somebody introduced you to it, you know, because I feel like that's how a lot of therapists come to EMDR. Mm-hmm. Somebody that they know professionally, whether it was a course they were taking or a class they were taking or maybe a conference they've recommended, you know, we're attending, and they were like, oh, what is this? I can, tell me more about this, you know, and that's how they come into it. So we're glad that you found it. And I'm sure that the people who have been your clients have been very happy that you found it as well, so they can heal from their trauma. So thank you for all that you do. Yeah, that's wonderful.
It is literal actual magic. And I think it's really interesting when I tried to describe it to my clients of like, this is what EMDR is. A lot of them are like, I don't think it's that efficient, or I've tried every other type of therapy. This isn't going to work as well as you say it's going to. And then bada bing, bada boom, it is wonderful.
Yeah. And then they're singing your praises. So that's great.
Yep. That's, and then they go around, they're like, everyone needs EMDR.
Yeah. Everyone kind of does, actually.
Yes, so, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely.
So what is your favorite part of working with EMDR and sexual trauma?
definitely enjoy about it is, you know, just being able to see how the mind and the body separate when that trauma occurs, and then how EMDR kind of puts those pieces back together, especially, you know, being that sexual assault is really unique, that it impacts our mind, our body, our spirit, our emotions, all at the same time. EMDR is a perfect fit for it because it really helps, you know, just kind of solidify you are a holistic being who had something fragment you, and now we get to sort of, you know, put you back together with your help, with your brain's help. I'm just moving my fingers. And I think also really being able to recognize patterns or factors that increase someone's chances of being assaulted, so that prevention work can then be implemented. So one of the things that I've really noticed working with sexual assault survivors is that they have absolutely had some sort of childhood experience or some sort of adverse effect happen to them where it kind of leads them down this path of my automatic trauma response is fawning or people pleasing. And that is typically how they end up in a situation where the assault occurs. It's not that they did something crazy or did something irresponsible or whatever. It's typically that they had some sort of past experience that then led them to being, unfortunately, a victim to this. Right. And so what I think of is, you know, the freezing or the fawning trauma response. I'm going to mention that a little bit later on with the questions, but I mean, that is so important to talk about because that is what happens, like when people are assaulted.
Right. Well, you touched on this a little bit earlier, and whenever you read about or watch any kind of news reports, whether it's a television show or it's a legitimate news report, and they talk to victims of sexual trauma, they most of the time they will say, it was like I wasn't there, right? My mind completely dissociated with what was happening to me physically, you know, or I was hovering over my body and I was watching it happen, but I couldn't do anything to prevent it. And so it's good that you touched on how all of that works against the person when it's happening and post when it happened, but then how EMDR therapy cycles through all of that and brings it all together and so that person can heal. So.
Absolutely.
So what successes have you seen using EMDR therapy for sexual trauma?
Yeah. So Kim, oh my gosh, many, many different ones.
Great.
This is the one where I'm like, how much time do you have? So I think the number one thing is just reclaiming their voice. So, you know, especially with the desensitization piece, right? So desensitizing them to the trauma, whether that actually looks like full-blown EMDR or just EMD, really desensitizing them to that trauma and getting them grounded in that present moment is huge. So that is like one of the biggest successes I've seen is to be able to get my clients to feel safe when they are actually safe. So safe in their body. And especially with their body, right? It's reforming a new relationship. So something happened to their body, whether actual like penetration happened when the sexual assault occurred is completely irrelevant. Something that they didn't want to have happen to their body happened to their body. And it's rebuilding that relationship with their body. So not fighting their body, not punishing their body, not ignoring or disconnecting from their body, that sort of facilitating like your body is a part of you and you need to celebrate it is huge. So that's one of the biggest things that I've seen in EMDR and what makes sort of this therapy really successful. Also realizing that they are not their trauma, that the trauma that happened is completely separate from them. They just are coping with that and integrating that. That is a huge thing and that they're not to blame for their trauma. Another thing that I've really seen sort of as a successful story of EMDR and how it works with these clients is having that aha moment when they realize that people go out and drink alcohol, people go out and they dress crazy or they don't wear anything at all. And that has nothing to do with predicting if sexual assault is going to occur or not. Right. It has nothing to do with it, right? People can go out and have drinks. People can go out and be crazy. They can make, you know, quote unquote, poor choices, if you will. There is absolutely no correlation between that and being assaulted. And so one of the things that I find super powerful about EMDR is the reprocessing, right? The reprocessing that negative cognition that I am responsible, I am to blame, this happened to me. It's like, no, the only thing that you did is you happened to be there. You happened to be in that situation and the offender offended you. That is what happened, right? So those aha moments of, oh, I guess I wasn't actually responsible for that, or I guess I am safe in my body. Those are huge. Absolutely huge.
Are there any myths that you would like to bust about EMDR therapy and sexual trauma?
So this one might seem pretty obvious, but I'm just going to say it because the stories that I've heard from my clients coming to me for specialized sexual assault therapy is pretty astounding. So please don't blame the survivor for the assault occurring. Like, I'm just going to go ahead and put that out there. Please don't do that. This doesn't look like overt blame. What this can look like as a therapist who is working with somebody who's been assaulted, it can also look like questioning them about their choices or trying to get more detail about things that are not really relevant to their healing. So one of the things I find really important about talking about victim blaming is, are you victim blaming because you are actually blaming the victim for the assault occurring? Or are you victim blaming because you are scared that the assault can actually happen to anyone and you are trying to make up excuses as to what that person must have been doing specifically in order for them to be assaulted?
Right.
Oh, you must have been going out and drinking and doing something crazy because I would never do that and therefore I'm safe.
Right. And you shouldn't be out walking at 4 a.m. and it's dark and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, oh, you didn't have your keys in between your fingers and you weren't ready to stab someone. So that's clearly why that happened. And it's like, no, that has nothing to do with it, right? So I think really just being super mindful that victim blaming can come out in a myriad of ways. It doesn't just have to be overt blaming. So just being extremely mindful as a therapist of how you ask survivors questions, because the myth is that victim blaming can actually take on many different forms. So I think that that's definitely one of the things is just please don't blame the survivor, even if you are not out loud saying like, it's your fault. Like, just be really mindful of that and be mindful of your past experiences. Because if you were trying to make excuses as to why the assault occurred, that is victim blaming. I mean, that truly is.
And you're not putting the blame where it lies, which is the blame lies on the perpetrator, not the victim.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%. Exactly. Yeah. I think a second myth would be that you don't need to be a sexual assault therapist to help your client process trauma related to sexual assault. Some of the clients that come to our organization, they are on our waiting list and they say, well, the therapist that I'm currently seeing now doesn't want to talk about my sexual assault trauma or doesn't feel comfortable in that area. And yes, while having specialized training in sexual assault is extremely helpful for knowing how to navigate that, you don't absolutely have to be a specific sexual assault therapist to touch on that subject. There are many things that you could do to be helpful in processing, just supporting and validating and being empathetic. Like, there are not a whole lot of things that you have to do or feel like you should do as a therapist to unpack all of this sexual assault trauma. So that is kind of just what I wanted to say about that, because the prevalency is so huge that, I mean, in my personal and professional opinion, sexual assault happens to at least 25% of people, at least, if not more. The statistic is 1 in 6, but it's more.
I can't remember it because it was a few years ago when they came out with these studies of, you know, because my daughter just graduated from college about a year and a half ago. And so that's always on your mind when you send away a child anywhere in an environment like that. And an adult child. And the statistics for college students who get sexually assaulted are just astounding.
It's crazy.
You know, and I'm like, you guys, you're there for class. You know, this is, it just really blows my mind, you know? And so, it happens a lot more because, you know, a lot of people don't report it, right?
And I will definitely be touching on that, that victim-blaming cycle for sure. Yeah. Because there are both pros and cons for reporting. And I think that that's really important to talk about, but absolutely. Right. It's like, how are we to know that places are safe? And again, it goes back to, we don't, unfortunately, we don't know if people are safe. We want to inherently believe that people are good and that they are trying their best. Right.
But and you can trust them and
you can unconditionally trust people. They're gonna, you know, they're not gonna hurt you. And I think the really sad truth is that we just don't know. We just really don't know.
That's true. You don't. Yeah. You absolutely don't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely don't.
Yeah.
So are there any, well, this is a loaded question, but are there any specific complexities or difficulties with using EMDR therapy for sexual trauma?
Yes. The answer is yes. The short answer is yes. So I think one of the most complex things that a lot of EMDR therapists may or may not understand is that when you ask a sexual assault survivor if they feel safe in their body or if they feel safe right now, even though objectively maybe nothing unsafe is happening around them, they might say no. they might say, no, I don't really feel safe. And it's not that your office doesn't feel safe or the environment that they're in doesn't feel safe. They don't feel safe in their body. And so one of the complexities really is, how do we figure out how to establish a calm, safe present versus a calm, safe space? So the difference on that is, you know, if they're in your office, make your office the calm, safe present. You know, make that the present moment that they need to be grounded in and where they need to come back to at the end of every session. Just because if they don't feel safe in their body, they're not going to feel safe with you. They're not going to feel safe, you know, where they're having their therapy, if it's online or whatever. So that I think is a huge thing, spending extra time on developing what a calm, safe present looks like and having them ground themselves in that present moment and feeling safe in their body. Absolutely. I would say a second thing would be screening for dissociation. So whether you as a therapist, you can have all the training in the world on dissociation, right? But I think that dissociation really happens like when they're not in our office. It could absolutely be that they're dissociating in our office. Absolutely. But I think a huge piece is really screening for dissociation, no matter how they present in your office. So I have found that when I screen for dissociation, like it is very prevalent. Like they are often, especially after an assault, but even if they have had, you know, some sort of adverse childhood experience happen to them, like dissociation is extremely prevalent. And that's the thing that is kind of getting them through life. So figuring out how to screen for that, what that looks like, providing psychoeducation for your client on that, all of that is very, very important because it's going to impact how they process things with EMDR. If they are checking out, if they're dissociating, if they're having out-of-body experiences, all of that stuff is going to process or impact how they're processing. So that is a huge thing. Screen for dissociation, because that's going to make things very complex if you do not. And also, while you are talking about dissociation with them, have them in between sessions make note of what it feels like to dissociate in their body or from their body, what it feels like to bring themselves back into their body, and what are the most effective grounding techniques that they can use, because oftentimes like those are going to be the grounding techniques that they need to use in session with you, especially after processing the thing that makes them dissociate. So that would just be one of the most complex things, is just dissociation, I think, with a lot of clients, but especially with sexual assault survivors. The next thing I would say that is complex would be that therapists, EMDR therapists, are afraid to jump right into processing the sexual assault trauma. I want to say that I think that there are many factors that kind of dictate if it will be extremely re-triggering, like as triggering as we think it's going to be, or if it's going to be fine. So a couple of those factors are, you know, the nature of the assault. So how violent was it? What happened? What was the level of physical, emotional, or mental or sexual violence that was used? What was the age that they were when they were first assaulted? So how old were they when they were first assaulted? That is going to be really big, and also a predictor of dissociation. The younger they are, the more dissociative they're going to be, because their brain was not able to compartmentalize and process what happened to them. The number of assaults that they've had in their lifetime is going to be huge. If they are coming to you as a client who is maybe, let's say, an adult, has never experienced a sexual assault in their lifetime, and then experienced an assault, when they come to you, processing that trauma may or may not be as re-triggering as somebody who's experienced a childhood sexual assault, had that sort of repressed for many years, and then is now finding that it's coming up and they want to work through that. So that's a huge thing as well. Just how old were they when that assault occurred? The number of assaults that they have had in their lifetime is also going to dictate that. Is this, again, the first assault? Is this one of many? That is also absolutely going to be sort of determining if it's going to be re-triggering for them. If they have had any other assaults at all in their lifetime or any other abuse in their lifetime, this is where the ACEs comes in handy, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Questionnaire or scale. This is where this comes in handy, is screening out for that, figuring out, did you process that through therapy or by other means? Or is that kind of impacting how you're not or processing the trauma right now? Also, the support or help that they received directly after the assault, is that something that they received at all? Because if they received no support after their sexual assault experience, chances are it's going to be very re-triggering when you bring it up in therapy or when you process it with EMDR. But if they felt pretty supported, if they felt like, no, actually, like I feel really supported, I feel validated, I feel empathized with, then bringing that up in therapy with EMDR is not going to be as re-triggering as if they had absolutely no support at all. I think something else too is the relationship with the offender. That is a huge piece. basically 99% of all offenses, realistically probably 95, but I'm going to say almost 100% of all offenses occur where the offender is someone that the survivor previously knows, if not knows very well. So when that happens, typically that results in self-blame for the survivor, guilt, untrusting of self, and a lot of internal locus of control issues. Whereas if the offender was a stranger, that sometimes or mostly results in fear, untrusting of the world, and external locus of control issues. They don't know what's going to happen in the world around them versus I am the problem. There's something wrong with me. I create all of, you know, the bad things that happen to me. Another thing too, the last thing would be their current support system. So when they leave your therapy office, do they have support to go to, or are you their only support? If that's the case, ending EMDR sessions is going to be really hard for them if you are the only person who believes them or trusts them and can provide that ongoing support throughout the week when they are not in your office. So those are things, it's a lot of things, but those are all things to consider when you are wanting to unpack the trauma with them and kind of a predictor on how re-triggering it might be. So that would kind of just be my guidelines and experiences.
Those are great guidelines. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you practice cultural humility as an EMDR therapist?
Yeah. So first off, super love that this question is even asked. Love that. For those who cannot see me, I am a white, able-bodied female who has had the privilege of having education and a career that I love. So these are things that I absolutely keep in mind as I go into my sessions. Like, I am coming from a completely different background and I have privileges that I acknowledge. I make no assumptions about anybody's identity or parts of their identity or what they choose to talk about with me in session, what they choose to hold dear to them, what they choose to reject. Those are all things that nobody should make assumptions about, and I especially don't. And so I really encourage and empower my clients to tell their stories. They are the expert of their own lives. Tell me what is important to you. And if there's something that we haven't touched on or that, you know, you're finding that I am just unaware of, make that known to me. Like, truly, like, I want to know you as a whole. For my organization too, what I really, really enjoy about working for Providence Intervention Center for Assault and Abuse in Everett is, in response to George Floyd in 2020, we created the Equity, Inclusion, and Accountability Work Group. And we did an overhaul of all of our materials, everything that, like, we internally use as providers and things that we externally give out to clients. And it was phenomenal. Like, the things that we came up with, the things that we were like, oh, Lord, that is outdated. The things that we were able to see and recreate and reconstruct were incredible. Like, for example, we created a phone tree that made it a little bit more easily accessible to actually get to where you wanted to call and the services that you wanted to receive. We created or implemented TTY options for folks who are hearing disabled. We reconstructed our website and our brochure with more inclusive language, gender-affirming care, non-discriminatory services, and more inclusive pictures that were more ambiguous, not outlying, like, you know, thin friends and family, like hopping over a lake to signify right. health. It was like, you know, hands and reaching for, you know, trees and things like that. So more symbolic, this is what healing looks like versus this is who healing looks like. We also created a client feedback survey to encourage the voices and populations to give their feedback on what services or what needs we were not providing or meeting, and to see what we were doing well. So that's always good to know. So getting community voices, I think, was huge for us. And that has been continuously changing the services that we provide to be more geared towards people who really, really need them.
Yeah, that's great. I worked in associations for a long time, and I've presented before at conferences about magazines and publishing and communications and all of those things. And we talk about those things, and we talk about surveys because, you know, quite frankly, when you have an organization, you have to ask mm-hmm. members or your customers, if you're a business, how are we doing? Right. But I always tell people, if you don't want to know the answers, don't ask the questions, because you yes. need to be ready to make the changes when that feedback comes in. Right.
Absolutely.
And you need to be able to look at those trends and figure out what you did really, really well and keep doing it, and what you need to improve on and how you're going to fix that. Mm-hmm. So to anybody out there who's working in an agency like you are, it's good that you also do that kind of as a, not a follow-up, but as part of your package mm-hmm. when you're working with clients. This is just how we do it. We ask you what we do well and what we don't do well, and then we make changes within. So thank you guys for doing that.
Yeah. And I love that, right? About like, you better be willing and able to make those changes.
Yeah. Because... you have to be prepared because luckily, members will tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. They will tell you the truth about whatever you've asked them about.
Yep.
Some new program you've created or some direction you want to go or how the magazine is doing or whatever. And so they will tell you. So you have to put on a little bit thicker skin and be prepared because it might not be positive all the time. And then how are you going to adjust your future approach? So.
Absolutely. Well, and with statistics, so I also have a couple statistics to read because I think that it's really important to know the populations that are truly impacted the most by sexual assault violence and sexual assault trauma. The most at-risk people of being sexually assaulted are women of color, immigrant women, LGBTQIA+ women, and disabled women. So the fact that we did, we were finding that all of our brochures had, white families on them and we're just totally not accessible, not in different languages. It was just who are we trying to reach here? And why are we not doing something about the people who are actually at the most risk? That was something that I just thought was really wonderful about the organization that was willing to open up and actually do that. But at the same time, there are absolutely still stigmas around receiving care for these kind of things. And so, there's still so much work to be done.
There is. And I feel like it is extremely unfortunate that George Floyd had to happen at all.
Oh, absolutely.
But I honestly believe that, and I have seen it with organizations, that because of what happened with him, people have made changes and they have become more aware. And I don't, there's a silver lining to anything like that that's tragic. That would be it, is that people have finally opened their eyes and sort of removed the scales and said, hey, this is a problem that we have, not in just this country, but in a lot of countries. Mm-hmm. And here's how we're going to make some changes to press forward with this.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was the final thing, which is so sad to say, but it's that was the final thing to be hey, so are we going to make those changes now? Cause they had needed to be made before, but I think that now is a great time to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So do you have a favorite free EMDR related resource that you would suggest either for the public or other EMDR therapists?
Yeah. So for clients all the time, I use the emdria.org. All the time. The what is EMDR? Yep. All the time. go watch this video. If you have any questions, let me know. Yeah, that's, I love it. The just what is EMDR page is fantastic. And honestly, there is so much weirdness in terms of other EMDR resources that are not actually EMDR that I kind of forbid my clients to Google EMDR because I'm you will come up with the weirdest things and it's not going to be reliable. And this is what I think is really, really reliable. So if you have any questions or you want to know, stick within this website. So for my clients, that is the resource I absolutely give them. And then for EMDR therapists, obviously if you're an EMDRIA member, right, you can download those toolkits and you can download brochures and things like that. But, for an actual free website, there is EMDR Consulting. They have free training materials. They have templates that therapists can use for EMDR for their clients. It's all very, very helpful and it's all free, which is wonderful. Another thing too, just for therapists in general, therapistaid.com has been my savior as a community mental health therapist forever. They have amazing worksheets and handouts and things, and they're all super, they're super big font, which is wonderful. But they're also they're organized in such a way that it's visually stimulating. So it's not like you're giving your client this handout on here's 1,000 words about whatever. It is interactive. It has pictures, it has diagrams. So therapistaid.com is absolutely one of the best websites I've ever used. And then just in terms of sexual assault survivors. So if you're a therapist, whether you're EMDR therapist or not, but if you're a therapist looking for more resources on sexual assault trauma or trainings or things like that, or if you have a client who's been sexually assaulted and you want to refer them to a website where they can get more support, RAIN.org, incredible. That stands for the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network. And then for male survivors, so male survivors are of the minority of folks who are assaulted, but they still are assaulted nonetheless. Male survivors, the website is the number one in 1in6.org, and that stands for 1 in 6 males are assaulted. That is an incredible resource, and also with support groups and things like that. So males, at least my personal experience and professional experience working with males, the support groups are absolutely amazing. And also, there is so much stigma around that yeah. they are, if you talk with a male who's been, you know, assaulted, it's either I absolutely want a support group because I want to know and build relationships with folks who are in a similar situation to me, or they are the complete opposite. They're like, absolutely, I don't want anybody to know about this. I just want individual therapy. No. What I love about 1in6.org is it has a forum that acts like a support group, but has the anonymity of like not being in a support group.
Right.
So it's great. It's absolutely a wonderful website, and I recommend anybody to go look there.
That's great. Those are great resources. I've heard of RAIN, but mm-hmm. I have not heard of 1in6. So yeah. that's awesome. And what I'll do is I'll include all those links that you mentioned
in
the description of the podcast so people can just go click on them and see perfect. Them. And so, yeah, it's good that to hear members tell us that the website's useful. You know, we have not a weird mission, but our mission is, you know, very much, it's dichotomous, right? It's, you know, trying to get people interested in EMDR therapy who might want to add that to their therapy practice mm-hmm. professionals, but it's also for the public.
Yes.
Our find an EMDR therapist, you know, directory and resources so the public can understand if they are seeking EMDR therapy or if their therapist mentions it to them, they can get more information. And so it's good when we hear members tell us that they use that information and share it with their clients. So thank you so much for doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say too, another amazing resource, WCSAP. So WCSAP, it stands for the Washington Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs.org. It is incredible because, again, it's a free website. It's for Washington therapists, but I mean, anybody could really benefit from the information. They have information on how to be an advocate for somebody who's been sexually assaulted, which I think therapists are advocates. So that information is wonderful. And it also has some videos. Some are free, some you have to pay for, but the free ones are still wonderful on how to facilitate sexual assault survivor support groups.
Wow.
So
okay. That
is a really wonderful resource as well.
There you go. Thanks. What would you like people outside of the EMDR community to know about sexual trauma?
Many, 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 many things. Many things.
So many things. We need an extra hour in our podcast.
I know. So many things. The first thing really is just how prevalent sexual assault is. Like, it is just so prevalent. You are not going to be a therapist in your lifetime and not come across somebody who hasn't been assaulted. That's not something that's going to happen. You are absolutely going to have clients in your chair who have been sexually assaulted, whether they tell you that or not. I mean, that is something that is just so prevalent. And again, when I say that the statistic according to RAIN right now is 1 in 6 females will be assaulted in their lifetime, I professionally believe that it is much more like 25%. So 1 in 4, or even 1 in 3. Wow. I mean, it is so prevalent and so not talked about. And the underreporting is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So it is something that is extremely prevalent. So just know that you will most likely have people in your chair who have been assaulted. And I think it's really, really important to talk about why people report versus why people don't report and kind of what the fallout is of that. So the statistic, unfortunately, is that of all cases, men and women, or any gender really, anybody who's been assaulted, the statistic right now, according to, I think it's the FBI cases or something, is only 30% of all cases are ever reported. Hmm. And so that is so low.
Yeah.
So low.
That's incredibly low.
Too low.
I do understand why people would not want to report.
Yes.
I mean, absolutely. There's just a whole myriad mm-hmm. of reasons why.
Oh yeah.
They wouldn't want to share that information. Yeah.
Oh, it's nuts. And I mean, the process of reporting is so tedious. So when I talk with clients and, you know, they tell me that they've been assaulted and they're kind of like, oh, I don't know if I should report or not. You know, the thing that I tell my clients is that it is not my duty to report for you. Like, that is not something that therapists should or could do. We cannot report to the police that somebody's been assaulted. The only stipulations, right, would be obviously if they're under, you know, if they're a kid or if they're under a certain age or if they have a disability or if they are a vulnerable adult, that is different. Right. When it comes to an adult, we cannot report to the police for them that there's been a crime that's occurred. That has to be a personal choice that they make. I mean, it's very tedious. They have to be the ones to go and talk with the police. They have to be the ones to go and work with a detective. They have to be the ones to go and work with a prosecuting attorney. They have to be the ones who are, you know, working with being in constant contact with a prosecuting advocate. I mean, it's a lot. And every single time that they get an email from, you know, the court system or from their advocate saying, you know, any updates really on the case, it reopens that wound. And it's really, really hard for them to continue to move forward in their healing.
Yeah.
So the problem with not reporting is because of underreporting. What we have here is we have a vicious, vicious cycle. So offenders are not really held accountable because there's not a whole lot of people reporting. And even if there are no structural or, you know, things in place to hold these folks accountable. There's no, if you do this, then you get certain amount of jail time. Each case is judged individually, which is, I think, a little bit of BS.
Yeah. And I agree.
Yeah. It's just a little bit of BS.
Sometimes when those headlines make the news, you're like, really?
Yeah.
That's all that person got for that heinous crime?
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
Ugh. And other survivors see that and they go, wow.
Why bother?
Why bother? What is the point of that? If they're only going to get 3 months in, you know, jail with the option of, you know, not being in jail, like having on work release or something, like what is different about their life? Like, and if it's sometimes, like if it gets downgraded from like a crime to like harassment or something, it's like, is that even going to be on the record? Like there's just so many questions around that. And I think that because there is so much underreporting, what happens is that the repeat offenders, oftentimes they don't get held accountable because people are not reporting that they're, you know, offending multiple times. What happens is that then there are no institutional changes. There's no structural changes. There's no laws put in place. And then that just kind of makes the survivor go, well, what is the point? Just like we said, right? Why bother? And then it's just an awesome feedback loop. Just horrible. Why would I report? There's nothing happening. The offenders are not getting in trouble. Why would I report?
Right. Well, and then if you add to that the mix of if the perpetrator was someone that you know or someone who was a family member or, God forbid, someone you were married to or in a relationship with, that adds a whole nother level of, do I do this or not?
Yeah.
Do I report this or not? You know,
what trauma or what turmoil or what, you know, family dynamic is this going to do for me? And is that going to be something that I can live with?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so that's like that's what happens if we don't report, right? So that horrible feedback loop continues. And then if we do report, and again, this is a completely personalized choice for the survivor. Like you can give your input, but don't ever try and persuade them to report because you as a therapist are not the one going with them on all of these things. You are not, you know, sitting there with them having a pleasant night and then they get a phone call from the prosecuting attorney. Like that's not something that you have to deal with them. I mean, you can support them through that, but you don't actually have to deal with that. It's such a personalized choice that, you know, as a therapist, you're not legally or ethically allowed to do that, to make that choice for them. And it is something that is really difficult because it takes time. I mean, I think that a lot of survivors are absolutely hoping that, you know, okay, once I report, then definitely this person will be, you know, charged. They will definitely have something on their record and they definitely will be in jail. And those definitelys are absolutely not definite, especially with COVID backing everything up in the court system. Cases are all backed up. And to my understanding, at least with my organization, what I'm understanding is that they are prioritizing cases based on how safe the survivor is. So if there's immediate needs for safety or immediate needs for this to go to court, or if it's children's sexual assault cases, those I think are being prioritized versus others. And so, you know, if you, you know, had a sexual assault experience with somebody who was a dating acquaintance, and let's say you don't even live in the same county as them, unfortunately, I don't know, based on kind of that relationship, I don't know how much that's going to be prioritized, which how fun does that feel to be put on
delay the agony?
Horrible. And so a lot of survivors have their healing contingent on the offender being prosecuted.
Right.
And that is so dangerous because that gives the offender more power. That just gives them more power. It's their outcome, their life is now dictating how much you can heal or how much you can move on from this.
Right.
And so as a therapist, I think it's really important too, to let them know, we are going to be healing through this regardless what happens. If your healing is contingent or reliant on this person getting everything that you think they deserve, that may or may not happen. We cannot put our eggs in that basket. That just will not happen.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. Now, this question is not on the list, but because of what you do and clients that you work with all day, how do you manage your self-care?
Yeah, that is a huge piece that I really appreciate that my organization prioritizes. So if things are really tough, so let's say that, you know, I don't know, there's been multiple cases, you know, there's nothing happening in the courts. Everybody's just feeling down, hopeless, whatever. I mean, it is so important for just everybody in the organization, but especially the therapist, to take care of themselves. One of the things that I really enjoy doing is I have a routine for closing up shop at work. So I wear a lanyard when I go to my organization, and my end of the day routine is balling up that lanyard, throwing it in my glove box and slamming the glove box and being like, you know what?
I'm done for the day.
I've done everything that I can possibly do. I am done for the day. My responsibilities are done. My responsibility is me now. Yes. I'm going to go home and play with my dog and, you know, do whatever makes me happy. So having that end of day routine, I think, is really important, because that mentally just and physically kind of releases you from carrying those things home with you.
Yes.
Because I mean, just sexual assault trauma is just so heavy. So that is, I definitely think, one of the things. Exercise has been, obviously, we talk about, like, you know, self-care with our clients and, oh yeah, you should exercise, eat right, be healthy, you know, do all these things. But I mean, exercise is just such a release. I think that especially with therapists sitting on our booties all day,
right.
Or, you know, if we have a standing desk and we're doing virtual, that's awesome, but we're still not, you know, moving
around. Right. Yeah. You're just standing. Yeah.
We're just standing. Right. And we're kind of standing and absorbing like all of the stress. Right. So movement is just so important. So at least for 30 minutes a day, I try my absolute best to incorporate some movement, whether that's like going on a walk or doing anything. I mean, truly anything, any type of movement. I also have steered away from the news.
Yeah.
Because, oh my goodness, if I see, you know, victim blaming headlines, regardless if it's sexual assault or not, like any victim blaming headlines, I'm just like, oh, just get reignited. So that is something that I absolutely do. I also encourage my clients, you don't have to watch the news.
Right.
And you can occasionally check in with what's going on in the world. You don't have to watch the news.
Right.
Because that's not a thing.
Well, it's good that you mentioned that. I manage our social media accounts along with the magazine and our e-news and content on the website. And I don't know, 8 or 10 times a day. I mean, I schedule our social media, but then 8 or 10 times a day, I'll go to our Twitter page just to see what's trending. In case there's anything I need to be aware of from a news perspective, right? And if there's something that's happening, like, for example, the earthquake in Turkey and Syria that just happened earlier this week, you know, I know that I need to set up a post about early intervention and EMDR Turkey and resources available and But let me tell you, it's depressing as hell a lot of times to look at what's trending and see the vitriol and the anger and just the general meanness that happens in social media. People hide behind their real name or their fake name, whichever they're doing. And so it's hard sometimes, and you have to just learn to step away. I mean, I'm a news junkie. I was a journalism major in college. So, you know, I start my day reading the news, and I read four newspapers. And so I try to avoid looking at that the rest of the day. And I have not watched a newscast since, I think, 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
I don't watch news on TV because number one, I read it. Mm-hmm. Number two, I don't need pundits to tell me what the president just said in his speech that I just listened to. Mm-hmm. And I don't need you guys arguing about your issues.
Yeah.
And that to me is not healthy and it's not fun. And so I don't watch, you know? And so, you have to learn how to step away. And another thing, and you didn't mention it, but I think another thing is, God, social media. Let's talk about how you know, just in general, you know, the filters and the this and the right poses and the right angles and all that. And then we're taught to live up to this perfection that we're seeing with all these, you know, fake photos that are posted or all these what we think people's lives are. Right. I had a friend who said, you know, social media is so sanitized. Right. Mm-hmm. You're just seeing what people want you to see about their life, not what's really happening once the door's closed to their home. Yeah. And so I remember that when I see things in my feed and I wish I could go on vacation there and I get a little, you know, jealous. And then I'm like, you know what? their family life may be crap for all mm-hmm. I know. You know, I don't really know. I'm just seeing them on vacation somewhere really cool. And that doesn't mean that they're living the life they want. That just means they're on vacation. And mm-hmm. so I think a lot of us would benefit if we spent a little bit less time
yes.
scrolling.
Yeah. Absolutely. And truly, I think what it is true is just scrolling. It's like,
yeah.
it's
what do they call it? Doom scrolling.
Doom scrolling. Yeah.
Doom scrolling. Doom yeah.
Scrolling.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's so easy. I mean, you pick up your smartphone and you just let your thumb do the work, right? You don't even mm-hmm. have to like type anything. You just
yeah.
let your fingers do the walking, right?
Yeah. Oh, instead. And those timers that you set on, you know, for like, I don't know if you have like an iPhone, but like you can set timers, right? On
yes.
like how much time you spend on social media. Do you know how easy it is to hit the ignore button? Do you
yes.
know how often I hit the ignore button? It's my snooze
yes.
button. It's like, no, hold on. I was watching something. Hold on.
I'm not done yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just like with the news. I mean, it is made to be entertainment. It's made to be consumed. And
right.
so it's going to be easily consumed. And that's the problem, is that, you know, if it is so much easier to disconnect and focus on other people's problems or other people's lives versus sitting with yourself and really figuring out like what is going on internally with me right now, whether you're a therapist or a client, right? I mean, what is going on with me internally right now? It is so easy to disconnect and frankly dissociate, you know, by being consumed by all these things or consuming all these things. Yeah. I mean, to really step away from that takes energy. It takes focus. It takes practice. And it does not come easily because, again, those things are made to make us addicted to them.
Correct. They are. Yeah. What was that Netflix documentary? The Social Experiment?
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. And all of
that
them
was
are like
eye-opening. Holy cow.
And all of the CEOs and stuff are like, oh, yeah, no, I would never let my kid do that. It's like, well, like, but you're
but
like,
it's okay for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So absolutely. And yeah, I have a business Facebook for my private practice, but I literally just made that. And I only made it because the networking right now is only done over Facebook.
Right.
So like I'm in a bunch of therapist groups and I really enjoy all of the resources that they give. I enjoy being to say like, hey, my client needs a support group for X, Y, and Z and have like 40 choices and responses.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I have not found anything like that out there. And unfortunately, I have to be on Facebook in order to access that.
Right,
so
right, right.
Like,
exactly.
I can't disconnect completely, which is a bummer, but.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah. I have toyed with over the years because I've seen friends do it. They're like, okay, I'm giving up social media for Lent. I'll see you guys in 40 days. And I'm like, God, could I do that? I mean,
right?
I think I could because honestly, it was only 10 or 12 years ago. I didn't even have social
mm-hmm.
media, right? You know, I was on Twitter first because it was a public forum and I was the editor of a magazine and I was pushing our content out from my personal account to, you know, connected that way. And then a friend of mine convinced me to be on Facebook. So I'm like, you know, I can do it. I can't mm-hmm. be without it. I've done it before.
Yes. I don't have a problem. I can definitely give this up.
Yeah. We'll see.
One of the last things I did want to say, just in regards to what would you like people outside the EMDR community to know about sexual assault trauma, aside from the difference in reporting, right? Like what is good about reporting? What's bad about reporting?
Right.
Underreporting is so prevalent. One of the last things I would really, really like people to know as an EMDR therapist working with this population would be how important it is to talking about the fawning trauma response. So there is fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. If you ask any of your clients who have not been to therapy before, or maybe they have, but a while ago, they are most likely not familiar with the fawning trauma response. This is usually when I talk with my clients, they're like, what in the heck is that fawning? And it's like, yes. So fawning is literally people-pleasing as a trauma response. It is going along with the situation until things are safe enough to then engage in fight or flight. And
yeah.
freeze and fawn are both dissociative trauma responses, whereas fight and flight, you have to be in your body in order to be active and go do whatever. And so that's why screening for dissociation is so important, is because if the person, you know, if your client knew the person, if they were already engaging in people-pleasing behavior with this person, because God forbid they were emotionally disruptive to the relationship at all, something bad might happen, and then a sexual assault occurs, they were most likely very dissociative when that happened. And again, the self-blame, the things like that. Why did I do that? Why didn't I say no? Why didn't I leave? Why didn't I do X,
right.
Y, and Z? It is so important to tell them like, hey, your brain and your body made a split decision to decide that it is actually safer for you based on all the information you had available at that time it is safer for you to go along with whatever's happening versus make any kind of waves. Yeah. And people really need to know that, because there is so much self-blame that happens. And
yes,
yeah, it is just, it's nuts. And so also having that recognition of what fawning is, people can then kind of take that information and be like, oh, I do this every single day. Or, oh my gosh, like I see why I've been doing it. I see what purpose it serves me, but also I see the damage it causes. And I see that I'm a shell of the person that I want to be because I'm doing everything for everyone else and I have no boundaries. Right. So that is,
I would suspect that fawning happens also a lot in harassment at work, when you're in a work situation and somebody is inappropriate and you don't know how to respond, and you just kind of go along with whatever's happening because
you just
don't know what to do. Right. Mm-hmm. You're at work and you're like, oh, well, maybe this person didn't mean what they said this way, or maybe mm-hmm. this brush was accidental, or blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then later, you know, you go back to your desk or your office or you're on the metro going home, and you're like, oh, crap, this is what really happened, and that should not have happened that way.
Right.
And so I suspect that happens a lot. And I suspect that also happens, not that it's an age thing, but I would suspect it also happens with younger mm-hmm. clients who experience those things because mm-hmm. they're just young and they don't mm-hmm. know and they don't understand yet and they don't know really what's appropriate and what's not. And so it's good you brought
especially,
that up.
Well, and especially that example you just gave of the workplace harassment. So mm-hmm. especially since, you know, sexual assault is about, or really just any abuse in general, but especially sexual assault is about power and control rather than right. sexual intimacy or desire.
Right.
I mean, if you are sexually harassed by your boss at work, right, what are you to do? Who do you go and tell? If they right. are the person who is in charge, in power, and they are trying to have power and control over you, what are you to do? So mm-hmm. there is a lot to be said about just what it means to be a victim of sexual assault trauma, but also to have that fawning trauma response. Like, it has saved you from many, many, many things, like losing your job or
right.
creating family turmoil that you now have to deal with on a daily basis, or being bullied or whatever. I mean, it absolutely has saved you from a lot of things. And also, now that you are safe, now that you are out of the situation, now that you are no longer around the offender, hopefully, what does this look like for you? Like, right. is there a way for us to challenge the fawning trauma response to figure out like how you can get more power over yourself?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
It's great. I'm glad we talked about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
So if you weren't an EMDR therapist, what would you be?
Yeah. So I was thinking about like long and hard about this question. I was like, would it be something?
I've heard all kinds of answers. Yeah. So you can be serious or you can be fun. It doesn't matter what your
right?
answer is. It's all
like,
right.
I think my serious answer would be neuropsychology was absolutely my favorite class in my master's program. I absolutely loved learning about the different parts of the brain, how some medications work on the brain, how trauma impacts the brain, how different parts of the brain are seriously, they maladapt. Or they malform to whatever has happened to you. So if you experience, you know, childhood trauma, like your brain, the different parts of it, especially your limbic system or your feeling system, it's just going to look completely different to somebody mm-hmm. who didn't have childhood trauma, which yeah. is crazy. So I think, and that's also another reason why I love EMDR therapy, is because it can actually reshape your brain. Unlike yeah. medications, which are super important, that if yeah. medications are not working for you, it might not be a chemical thing. It might just be your brain. Yeah. So I think that on the back end, instead of working with clients, neuropsychology, doing research, things like that, I think that would definitely be the route that I would take. And also a more like not so serious answer would be anything with dogs. Love okay. dogs. It would be, I think... In a perfect world, I would love to incorporate dogs into therapy. Mm-hmm. I have, and if anybody out there wants to go in on this business idea with me, that would be awesome. I have an idea where we go to shelters, like me and whoever else knows what they're doing. We can go to shelters, kind of screen out what dogs may or may not be really good, like service animals or companion animals mm-hmm. or emotional support animals, bring them to wherever we work, have somebody train them be emotional support animals and have them sit in with the clients. And then maybe those clients are like, oh, I love this animal. I want to adopt this animal. And maybe it can have some sort of wonderful effect where we're helping the dogs and we're helping the people. So that would be like my ideal dream job or just volunteering with dogs.
Something not so serious, right?
Something not so serious. Just literally anything with dogs.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
you know, with April being Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So first off, wear teal. That's how you show your support during that month. But also, I don't know if folks know this, but the last Wednesday in April, so this year it's on the 26th, is what's called Denim Day. And basically, folks need to wear jeans on this day. Yeah, to stand in solidarity with sexual assault survivors. And how this came about is in 1998 in Italy, an 18-year-old girl was sexually assaulted by her 45-year-old driving instructor. He was released a year later after court overturned his sentence, stating, get this, stating that the girl must have had consensual sex with him because she was wearing tight jeans and they could only have been taken off with her help.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, and literally, I mean, Italy was up in arms. And so the women of Italy, the next day after this was overturned, based on this reasoning, everybody wore jeans and was just like, this is it. Yeah. So yeah. So it's a great way to kind of just stand in solidarity with survivors because I mean, again, nobody ever asks for it. Nobody ever deserves for this to happen to them. But especially it has absolutely nothing to do with what you wear. I could be wearing, nothing. And it doesn't mean that I deserve to be assaulted. So anyway, I just thought that that's kind of an interesting little thing. And it's called Denim Day, again, every last Wednesday in April. So I think the last thing that I would want to add is just reminding your clients, as an EMDR therapist, reminding your clients that healing is not linear. It is never going to be linear, which is super unfortunate. There's always going to be things that come in. There's always going to be good days. There's going to be bad days. But I think recovering from sexual assault trauma also does not mean going back to your old self. So it does not mean going back to your pre-traumatized self. It doesn't mean feeling like your old self again before you were assaulted. I think that this is a really hard pill for a lot of people to swallow because they just want to go back and pretend that this never happened. But healing is actually grieving your old self while empowering your new self to make a better version that is more sustainable, more resilient, embodies your mental, physical, and emotional best interest. So it is actually an opportunity for the survivors to start over, which doesn't sound fun. It takes a lot of energy, but the result that you get after you go to therapy, you do EMDR, you process all of the negative cognitions. It is pretty astounding how much better your life will be. How can I truly identify where I want to place my energy? It takes a lot of energy to heal. It takes a lot of energy to people please. And so oftentimes you cannot do both. And so figuring out how do I heal? How do I create, you know, all these healthy boundaries? How do I figure out myself? How do I figure out what I want? How do I get along with my body? All those things take time. And it is, again, not linear. So I think that really grounding your clients in that reality of it's going to take some time, but you won't feel like this forever. You won't feel traumatized forever. And especially with EMDR, right? I mean, the time is cut literally in half. But I think that that's just really important thing for folks to talk about with their clients.
That's a great way to end the podcast. Awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I mean, I think that this is just such an important issue to talk about. And especially, again, April being Sexual Assault Awareness Month, like no better time to talk about it.
This has been the Let's Talk EMDR podcast with our guest, Christina Anderson. Visit www.emdria.org for more information about EMDR therapy or to use our Find an EMDR Therapist directory with more than 14,000 therapists available. Our award-winning blog, Focal Point, offers information on EMDR and is an open resource. Thank you for listening.